cold and snow, snow and cold. Me and winter are both getting old. Yes, January's a time I'm likely to bark, but at least at 5 p.m., it's now not so dark. Ah, I love it. Hey, welcome to Spectrum West, everybody, where the arts and culture of Western Wisconsin has a home. And this week, I am pleased, I'm Al Ross, by the way, to bring you the second part of a conversation with percussionist and crazy good jazz drummer David Whitman, who has roots around here. His new album, Soul Flow, is out. He was here to get an award, and we corralled him in for a chat back in December, late December, just before Christmas. I also recently visited the Artisan Forge Studios complex in Eau Claire, where I met Bill Henry Walker, instrumental in getting the Sculpture Park up, that's along Claremont Avenue, and innovating with an art lending program that we will talk about. Then both special correspondents are with us this week. Catherine Thomas welcomes John Mueller, who brings his winter dance party to Eau Claire each year to relive the musical lives of Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and the Big Bopper. And what do you say we begin with a segment featuring Mr. Jim Oliver? This week, it's the production of A Shana Madel coming to the Phipps Center in Hudson. And as he always does, Jim lays a solid foundation.
Two sisters, one a survivor of Nazi concentration camps, the other brought up as an American. And they meet in 1946 after a separation of almost 20 years. The 1980 drama by Barbara LeBeau will open Friday and continue Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays through February the 2nd at the Phipps Center for the Arts, Black Box in Hudson. On the telephone from her home in St. Paul to talk about the play is the director, Mary Finnerty. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Thank you.
Tell us what attracted you to that show.
Well, I've actually wanted to direct a play for well over 20 years. I directed The Diary of Anne Frank when I was a teacher in New Richmond, Wisconsin, years and years ago. I took the students who were involved in it in 1983 to see a film at the Jewish Community Center of St. Paul that was called The 81st Blow. The film was actually a series of Nazi soldiers photographing and recording each other abusing Jews. And my students and I were forever changed. So it was at that point where I decided I needed to spend some time in my life really learning about it and doing everything I could to stem anti-Semitism, you know, stop it in its tracks, et cetera. So this play was actually offered to me shortly after it was written, and I was not able to direct it then. And then when John Potter sent me the notice that he was interested in looking at me as a director for this play, I just jumped at the chance. I thought, I'm not going to miss it the second time. It's funny, it's moving, it's hopeful, and it really shows and lays bare what it's like for a person deeply wounded by experiencing deep trauma after losing significant numbers of family members, beginning to heal and beginning to reclaim what little bit of family there is left. I find that fascinating.
The Phipps Advanced Promotional Material says it's not a depressing play about the Holocaust. Now, how did the author avoid the usual horror depicted in stories?
Well, I think that she found value in focusing on the results rather than on the actual crimes and murders that were committed. We start in Brooklyn, New York in 1946. The approach to the story is really interesting because she uses the past and the present simultaneously a lot in the play. So we'll be in the present and then our main character, Lucia, will slip into the past and start to experience something that has happened before. So her trauma becomes evident to us, but it isn't really about what was happening to her in the camps. It's like the effect that that had on her as a person. Barbara Liebel is very, very clear that she does not want, you know, images of the Holocaust or suffering. She doesn't want the audience to see those images. There is a scene where the actors recount who has been lost, and we hear a list of names of the family. But she creates this incredible humor in the play because the sister who was left in Poland with her mother because she got ill with scarlet fever is a very dignified Polish woman who at 29 is struggling very hard to speak English and has a lot of dignity and holds on to her Polish heritage. And she meets her sister, Her name is Razel, but she's renamed herself Rose in order to assimilate to America. And she's got a job and lives in Manhattan. And she's got this bouncy Brooklyn dialect. So she's just really forward and really confident and full of life. And Lucia is exhausted trying to pick her way through America. That sounds like a sad situation, but actually it's very funny because they try to understand each other and there's a lot of humor. So it's an interesting story about that. But then their relationship gets closer and we start to see the gifts they have for one another, of the love they can help each other to find that they've both lost from the past. There's these beautiful scenes about the love of a mother and the love of a sister and the love of a husband and wife that reclaim from the ashes of the terrible crimes that were committed, this fervor and strength to survive and go on and make new lives.
She is Mary Finnerty, the director of the Phipps production of Ashana Madel. I saw a couple of reviews. It's an emotional powerhouse of almost overwhelming proportions. Anyone who sees it will not soon forget it. It's staged in a black box.
Oh, yeah. A black box is just merely an empty space that then the designers can shape into a new space. It's a very intimate, beautiful theater. It has like 220 seats. You're never further than about 30 feet from the action. And there's an apartment from a Brooklyn brownstone. We have a bedroom, and in the center we have a living room, and on the right side we have a kitchen. And it's all, you know, done in the era of 1946. You know, it's beautiful to look at. It's cheerily decorated. And within that space, they both live in the present, and Lucia starts to remember things about the past and actually hopes for things from the future. There's some dancing in the play. There's Jewish music. There's singing. Lucia teaches Rose some songs from her culture and helps her to identify her own culture. And there's beautiful memories that they recall about their mother and about life in Poland. And so there's a lot of joy, and that's what makes the play so hard-hitting. What I love about it, it shows us really honest pain, but in the end, it allows us to witness the beginning of healing, and I think we need that in our world today. And the set itself is beautifully rendered by the designer and by our tech director, Mark Koski. It's just a lovely piece of design.
How many people are in the cast?
There are six, and they're wonderful actors. We have a man named Tom Averna, who is playing the role of Mordecai Weiss. He's wonderful. Adele Dolan is playing the role of Mama, his wife. And a young man from Hudson named Mitchell Bugney, who's a student at University of Wisconsin-River Falls. And he plays Lucia's husband, David. The main characters, the two sisters, are played by Mary Schaefer from Stillwater, and she plays the role of Lucia. And then Sophie Finnerty is from Minneapolis. She's a student at Augsburg College, and she's playing the role of Rose. And then Randy Berg is playing the role of Hannah, and she's from Augsburg College also. They're wonderful actors. They're deeply dedicated. They have really loved this process and meeting the experts that we've brought in to help them to understand the world, the dialects, et cetera. The dialects have been really fun and interesting for them, as have the information we've gotten from our Jewish consultants on the show.
There is a special presentation following the Sunday matinee performances on the 19th and the 26th. Rob Wertheimer, who is an Hudson attorney, will present Ruth's story, an account of his mother's experience as a hidden child during the Holocaust. It'll bring actuality, I suppose, to what is otherwise a fictional play. Just as a discussion of philosophy, I spent 2 years of my life in Germany at the end of the 1950s. The Holocaust was no big secret. Everybody knew it had happened. I was assigned fairly close to Dachau. I never went there. Didn't seem like there was any question, but yet every now and then somebody pulls his head out from under a rock and says, well, the Holocaust was just a lie. Do you have any reference as to why that continues to happen?
Well, we had a guest speaker, Kenneth Engel, the president of the Children of Holocaust Survivors in Minneapolis-St. Paul area. And he talked to us about the depth of commitment to Hitler's Mein Kampf. The answers lay in that piece of writing. Hitler's idea of this Darwinian world that he he structured with Jews at the bottom and needing to be eradicated in order for Germans, who were first, to flourish and accomplish all they must. This final solution of eliminating the Jews came from there. Sometimes people think the answers to a lot of difficult problems are to purify or to nationalize other groups in order to, you know, lift up this central core they feel they're a part of and that needs to be first. They feel they're being robbed of something. And as history tells us, so often people are pitted against one another when they're not the ones causing each other difficulty. It's an economic issue, or it's maybe a government issue, or officials hoarding resources that people are not allowed to have, or things like that. But I just think that mentality is on the rise in the world right now. And Ken really warned us about anything we say about the Holocaust. We need to be accurate. That's the sort of thing that gets attacked. So be very accurate about the details that you deliver, because those open the door for a disbelief of all of it. I think also it was such a horrific thing that a lot of people want to downplay it and say it just wasn't that bad. So I think that it's a complex answer about why deniers are denying. I had an interesting situation occur. We've been performing Anne Frank for 20 years, since 2000 at Park Square. Well over 250,000 students have seen that play. And after one of the discussions, or during it, I noticed that a lot of the students looked really confused. So I said, how many of you have heard of the Holocaust? And none of them had heard of it. And this school was all Muslim students, and they had never heard of the Holocaust, were never taught about it. They didn't know it existed. So we actually spent time talking about the events, how to find out more about it. So that was eye-opening to me, that there are parts of the world, certain religions or cultures, where it's really not something people are terribly aware of.
Well, the play is Ashana Madel. The Phipps Center for the Arts production opens this weekend in the Phipps Black Box and continues Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays through February 2nd. And we've been talking to the director, Mary Finnerty. Mary, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Tickets, details, and all things Phipps are found online at thephipps.org. That's P-H-I-P-P-S. Coming up on Spectrum West, Chapter 2 of Getting to Know David Whitman, and, oh boy, Catherine Thomas and John Mueller preview the Winter Dance Party. And next, an artist who enjoys spreading it around. Support for WPR comes from Marquardt Toyota, offering the fully redesigned RAV4 with all-wheel drive and new safety features, located off Highway 53 between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls, or at marquardttoyota.com. Support also comes from the Chippewa Valley Symphony, offering the Young People's Concert, performing music for the family on February 1st at 2 in the Pablo Center at the Confluence. Tickets and info at pablocenter.org. If you live in or visit Eau Claire frequently, you've undoubtedly noticed the large sculptures in front of the Artisan Forge Studios, that collective on Claremont. The energy behind the sculpture park is a gentleman named Bill Henry Walker. Two names, not three. Bill Henry the first name, Walker the last. He's been sculpting for many years, working to get widely noticed for those same many years, and it appears patience is paying off. His work is being heralded, and exhibits are popping up across America. We recently visited Artisan Forge and found that he believes as strongly in the work of others as he does his own.
For people who haven't been in Artisan Forge, it's a rather large complex, and it's filled with art of all kinds. I've seen it all. I shouldn't even say I've seen it all, because this is the kind of place that you should go through three, four, five times, and then possibly you will have seen it all. As you and I walked on first floor, second floor, there's sculptures, lots of different, as I said, kinds of art, glass, pottery, but there are a lot of pieces of visual art hanging on the walls. I'm looking at some of them now. There are some on the staircases, and I understand you can rent these for your home. Tell me about that process.
Well, this is an idea that came to me when I was visiting my Certale relative. She's working with an art lending group in Minneapolis, on a quarterly basis, they loan out 100 pieces.
I shouldn't have used the word rent then. I guess lend is the word.
Lend is the word, yes. So this is an art lending library, a no-cost borrowing of a piece of art. There's no fee involved. At the end of the three-month period, a person can choose to bring it back or buy the piece.
They can use the system by having fresh art in their home at all times. Is that one of the ideas, or is it to eventually sell the art and the loan process gives people an idea of whether it fits in their home or not?
Exactly. This is like a trial run. And, of course, I'm not opposed to people recycling the work and getting new work. This is good for the artist. It's good for the person. We're trying to build an art community of people who are collectors and who appreciate work. And you can't appreciate work unless you are looking at it and having it in your home. This is the beginning of interest in eventual purchasing. And what's been really interesting to me is that people have come in knowing that they could take a piece of work home at no cost and yet going home without anything. And I've queried some of these people and they have said, well, it wasn't the right size, or it wasn't the right color. I just couldn't find exactly what I wanted. So it's curious as to what enables someone to decide, yes, I want to take that piece of work home. And oftentimes people are thinking of in the back of their head, am I going to buy this piece? Then it has to be exactly perfect. I would like people to take the chance on taking something that isn't perfect for them, but that they might grow with, that this piece of work might teach them something. Mm-hmm. It's not the kind of work that they might originally choose, but because they can get it free, they can take that chance.
Now, the art that's available on loan, is it just the pieces that are on walls and in frames, or is it other kinds? Can people take a sculpture home?
Absolutely. We have a number of sculptures that are available, sculptures up to $5,000 in value that someone could take home. People have already taken expensive sculptures home and paintings.
How do they do that?
We're having our next lending period beginning the 21st of February. So the week leading up to that, people can come in and choose what they would like, pick out the piece, sign our little contract, contact information, and credit card, just in case they want to purchase the work, they can call us up and say we want to keep it.
Or God forbid there was any damage.
If there's any damage, we'll charge it to the card, show them a receipt.
So they come into Artisan Forge any time of day and ask for you, or what do they do?
Usually the place is open after 10 till 5 or 5:30. During that week leading up to the 21st, they can let their wishes be known, actually fill out an agreement, then pick up the work on the 21st, or have us take it out to them and hang it for them.
If my visualization of a calendar serves me correctly, that would be Valentine's Day week. That'd be a wonderful time to come in and find a nice piece of art, huh? Something you love?
Absolutely. Thanks for remembering that.
Well, that's what I'm here for.
I'll have to put it on my calendar for sure.
Put a big red heart.
Yes, thanks.
Okay, so let's get to know you a little better. Bill Henry Walker, you love art and you love getting art in people's hands and you love getting more people involved in the appreciation of art. The sculpture, I call it a garden.
The Artisan Forge Sculpture Park.
And that's very visible to all of us on Claremont Avenue. So you started out in California. I'm going to summarize your bio and you fill in the blanks. You ended up in Milwaukee, and then after Milwaukee, you moved here now 4 years ago in 2016 to Eau Claire. And you're a sculptor. How did you get involved in art?
When I finished my seminary training in Pasadena, you're shocked.
No, I think you're a nice guy. You could be a minister.
I had been working part-time at the Pasadena Art Museum and came to love some of the contemporary work that was being made. These people influenced my thinking, and as soon as I graduated from seminary, I started making art. I took a full-time job as a social worker, and I made pieces from 68 to 1972 that I actually have in a show at the Sioux City Art Center in Sioux City, Iowa.
Just closed, didn't it?
It just closed yesterday after a nice three-month run. It included 35 pieces of work, work that nobody else ever wanted.
That was an interesting aspect of your career. You didn't find acceptance of your work early. I'm fascinated by that because you just kept going. That's what an artist does, I guess.
And I really don't know why, but when you get a vision, you're capable of doing something, and you start pointing your life that direction, it's hard to get off that track. You can't become a stockbroker or a real estate agent after you've failed at your art. I picked up part-time jobs, which supported me and allowed me to buy materials, pay the rent, actually buy a building in Milwaukee, and kept my vision alive. I kept on building work and developing my ideas and my aesthetic, which is important to do this over a long period of time because there's a tremendous amount of growth and development that any artist has to do.
We're talking with Bill Henry Walker, and he's an artist, a sculptor, kind of recently moved to Eau Claire, becoming quite a player in the Artisan Forge community. And we're talking about a whole host of things in the Artisan Forge environment today. It's very possible you were ahead of your time. I mean, the way your sculptures, interestingly enough, they're being very much accepted and admired now. Good for you, because some people's art doesn't get discovered until it's a posthumous thing.
It's almost a posthumous thing, but not quite. My doctor guarantees me 10 more years.
Good. Well, then we have 10 more years of being able to see you standing next to your pieces.
I was doing fairly radical bas-reliefs on the walls using light, finally moved off the wall into sculpting. Some of these sculptures did find acceptance. In the mid-70s, I sold a number of acrylic pieces, but then I got tired of doing that, and I decided to go into polyester resin. Then I really hit the wall. So I did polyester resin for 10 years, sculptures up to 12 feet tall, and sold, I think, one piece in that period of time. I had all these pieces in boxes. When this curator in Sioux City found out about this work, he said, wow, I need a show in October.
If people want an idea of the kind of stuff you do, from what I looked at before I came in this morning, I'm guessing that there are two of your pieces out there.
I've got two pieces out there. One is a kinetic piece, which is 18 feet tall. It will move in the wind. And the other piece is a red piece. Several of the pieces in between are pieces that I brought in from artists from around the country.
Back to your original stuff. The theme's light and space. Is that still what you work with? Because originally the stuff I was looking at and reading about, it hung on the wall, but it was lit in such a special way that the shadows came into the equation.
Yes. So I was trying to use light in a different way. Originally, I was working with the shadows, playing light across a three-dimensional piece, which actually was made to look two-dimensional, but then the shadows created this conundrum that they shouldn't be there. So what I found through the years, like every 10 years, I'd find another way to use light. So now, instead of just haphazardly finding a piece to put light in, I'm trying to think light into all my work going forward. Light now has become a substance which generally reflects the inner life of a piece. These pieces are alive.
The brochure, which was very impressive from the Sioux City Art Center, had a really nice description of what you've done over the years, and also went into how your work is interpreted, and then brought up metaphor. That leads to, and we don't have much time, the art, and I call it an art, of naming pieces of work. They almost urged people to come up with their own metaphors when they view art. Does it bother an artist that someone could attribute a piece of art to something totally different than what you were thinking of when you named it?
I'm always interested by what people have to say. This helps to inform me and keeps me real. They have their own history of how they view things. They bring their history to me in their interpretation, and this enriches the piece as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you for being with us here on Spectrum West, and I have a feeling we'll be talking to you at various times over coming years.
It's great to be with you, and let your audience know what's happening here at Artisan Forge.
I will guarantee people, once they come, they'll want to come back. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Visit Artisan Forge. You will like it, and visit online at artisanforgestudios.com. Jazz drummer and sought-after West Coast and all-around percussionist David Whitman. He comes from around here on a career, an album, a life. Next on Spectrum West. You know, I wager Catherine Thomas was far from even a twinkle in the eye of her parents at the time, and yet she has an affinity for the days when rock and roll was just getting legs, figuratively and dancingly, as she exhibits in her ability to relate with and ask all the right questions of one who has commemorated the era on stage for many years, Mr. John Mueller.
John, the Winter Dance Party stops in Eau Claire at the Pablo Center on January 23rd, but it has its roots in another Winter Dance Party.
Yes, the original Winter Dance Party, of course, featured Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, Big Bopper, and Dion. It actually stopped at Eau Claire, Wisconsin, the original tour did, and it was at the Fournier's Ballroom, which I believe now is a parking lot. But we've been retracing their footsteps since the 40th anniversary of the original tour, which was 1999. We've been coming to Eau Claire every year.
Yeah, I didn't know that you had come to Eau Claire so many times. I know that you've been doing the dance party for a while, but wow, that's pretty
cool. Yeah, it's been really great. You see a lot of the same faces. We've grown up with people. I know this. I've seen girls, these little girls that were used to come to our show, and the parents brought them there when they were about 4 and 6 years old, and now they're in college. So that's how long we've been doing the show, but it's been great.
So talking about age, see, the Winter Dance Party, the original one was back in 1959, but it sounds like it has appeal to younger people even today.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the reason for that is one of Buddy Holly's crickets I had the pleasure of working with and meeting, Mickey Sullivan, told me that he believed the music is lasting because it's fun and happy music, kind of before rock and roll got into, political lyrics and stuff from, Dylan or Neil Young or whomever that carried it on in the 60s. But in the 50s, it was pretty much fun lyrics or, about love and heartbreak or whatever, and then a lot of dancing and just having a great time. And that's kind of, I think it's lasting appeals. And we kind of need that right now.
Mm-hmm.
We need some entertainment relief and in our complex times that we have with everything that's going on right now. And I think that's what makes it last. I make a joke during the show, since you brought that up. I say music's been going on for 61 years now, and I wonder if 60 years from now, if, the music of, say, Justin Bieber will be as popular. I don't think it will, I think this music has some kind of long-lasting appeal. It's almost like folk music now, where it's just kind of ingrained in people's minds.
It was during the Winter Dance Party in 1959 that all three, Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and the Big Bopper, were killed in that plane crash in Iowa. Do you think their tragic deaths had something to do with their ongoing popularity?
I think so, yeah, absolutely. It'd be hard to say no to that. But I also think, somebody coined that was the day the music died. They didn't even know if rock and roll was going to last back in the late 50s. It's hard to think that today, but it was true. Little Richard went back to being a preacher, so he denounced rock and roll in the late 50s. Jerry Lewis, of course, wedded his 13-year-old cousin, and so he kind of got banned from the radios for a while. And then this tragic plane crash happened, and it just kind of took the air out of rock and roll. And then there was like Bobby Sox kind of music in the late 50s and early 60s until the revolution happened with, Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and all that. It propelled rock and roll into a different era and different feel and whatnot. So, yeah, I think that plane crash, unfortunate that it happened, but it did happen at a timely point in the way rock and roll was progressing.
And they were all so young. I mean, Richie Valens was a teenager?
Just tragic. Yeah, he was 17. His life was just starting. He had a hit with Donna and La Bamba. And unique because he was like the first Hispanic rock and roller and just getting his life started, And Buddy Holly was only 22, and the Big Bopper was the old man of the group at 28. Rock and roll stars of their stature. Today they travel around in these state-of-the-art buses. And these guys were traveling around in school buses at some point. Their regular bus broke down many times. They did 11 shows in a row, and that's why Buddy chartered this plane. They just wanted to get ahead to the next city so they could get some sleep and get their laundry done and stuff. And these promoters back then, they would throw a dart at a dartboard and say, yeah, we got a booking here. It doesn't matter. That's 9 hours away from the last venue. Let's get them there just so they could make some money, you know. Just did not treat performers like they do today. If I have to point a finger of blame at anybody, it would be towards BAC Corporation that booked the original tour. That was New York City.
Are you superstitious at all about traveling? You're part of the winter dance party. I mean, I might be a little bit nervous.
Yeah. One time we had all three of us, my big bopper Linwood and Ray, as Richie Valens, on the little charter plane. I think we performed in Binghamton, New York, and we had to take a shuttle plane to a major airport to get to our next destination. And just a terrible flight, you know, where the plane drops all of a sudden and it's bumpy. And we're somewhat spoiled compared to what they had to go through.
This is Catherine Thomas. I'm talking with John Mueller about the upcoming Winter Dance Party, the tribute show featuring the music of Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and the Big Bopper. Your website says that you are the only show that's officially endorsed by the Holly, Valens, and Richardson, that's the Big Bopper, estates. You used to have Big Bopper Jr., his son, went on tour with you.
Yeah, it was great. I didn't even know the Big Bopper had a son, you know. He called me and heard what we were doing and said he wanted to be a part of it. I was like, of course. He was with us from like 2000 to 2013 until he passed away, unfortunately. Multitude of health problems. He did a song called Someone Watching Over You, where he felt like that was his connection with his dad. And it was always an emotional experience for the audience and for us, especially when we go into the original cities like Eau Claire and the ballrooms that still exist. And that's always a spiritual experience, just to be in the same building that they were in, you know, and kind of retracing their footsteps.
You play Buddy Holly in the show. So how do you make your performance as Buddy Holly authentic?
I try to let the John Mueller and me come out as Buddy. I never wanted the show to be one of those really bad, like, Elvis caricature things.
Yeah, I've seen a few of those.
There's quite a few tribute shows out there where people slap on some wigs and they, you know, kind of think that they know the music or whatever. But I was blessed that I worked with musicians that really understood and respected the music. And we rehearsed hours and hours and hours to try to replicate the original sound. My approach was always to go directly to the people that were involved in his life. I got quite a bit of inside information from his former bandmates and his actual family members. Good ammunition for me to present my stage performance. I think I also share a few of his personal characteristics. Hopefully that comes off when I'm on stage as well. At least I've been told that.
Okay, so we've talked a little bit about the Big Bopper, his big hit, Chantilly Lace, and
yeah.
Then you as Buddy Holly. And you mentioned earlier Richie Valens being a kind of pioneer in music. He was one of the first Latino rock and rollers. I heard a really good NPR story that talked about how his hit song, La Bamba, which was a Mexican folk song, is still considered very culturally relevant. There's a musical group out in California that reworked it into a kind of a hip-hop song about what it means to be American.
And even with Buddy Holly, it gives normal people hope that you don't have to look like Elvis Presley. Buddy was like the working man of rock and roll, where, you know, a guy wearing his big, nerdy-looking glasses. But he practiced in his garage with his bandmates, and based on the strength of his performance and his music, was able to break the barrier, as did Richie Valens, of not having to be a matinee idol to be a rock and roll star. And I think that gave a normal kid like myself hope and inspiration that you could make it in the music business and not have to be this perfect Brad Pitt or Elvis Presley looking kind of person. And the Big Bopper was originally a disc jockey. He was spinning black rhythm and blues type songs on the radio, and he got in trouble for that initially because it was too racy and controversial for those times. But he took those elements. At the heart of Chantilly Lace, it's kind of a very sexually oriented song, but he did it in a way that would get past censors. Bruce Springsteen said once in an interview that he'll play a Buddy Holly song backstage before he goes on stage just to keep him honest. Hundreds of others that were so influenced by these people. I know the Beatles, their first demo was That'll Be the Day by Buddy Holly, because they were just so highly influenced by his ability to write his own songs, and he had his own band. You know, we're going to do it all ourselves like Buddy Holly did.
Well, the Winter Dance Party, it's a dance party.
Yeah, that usually gets people bopping out of their seats.
Well, sounds good. We're going to party like it's 1959 then.
At the, that's right, Kevin.
Yeah, Winter Dance Party at 7:30 p.m. Thursday, January 23rd at the Pablo Center. Join John, who I've been talking to, and friends for the hits of Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, The Big Bopper, and many more. Tickets at pablocenter.org. John Mueller, we'll see you there. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Kevin. I really appreciate it.
Well, I wish I could play that whole song. That brings back a lot of memories. But let's do this. Before Jim Oliver leaves the building, here is what's on stage.
Murder Medium Rare. The Eau Claire Children's Theater Murder Mystery Dinner Theater will be presented Friday and Saturday, and next Friday and Saturday in the Oxford Theater. Agatha Christie's A Murder is Announced, a Miss Marple mystery, will be presented by the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild through Sunday and the following Thursday through Sunday in the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. The Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson has scheduled auditions for Busybody from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Monday and Wednesday at the Phipps. Persons interested must call the Phipps to make a reservation. The Red Barn Theater of Rice Lake will hold auditions for its coming summer season from 9 a.m. to noon on Saturday in the Fine Arts Building of the UW Eau Claire Barron County in Rice Lake. This year's season includes Ripcord, Doubt, Legally Blonde the Musical, Above Board, and the Great American Trailer Park Musical. The season will open May the 27th.
Thank you, sir. This is Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from the Great River Shakespeare Festival in Winona. This season features The Tempest, Great Expectations, and the one-person play Every Brilliant Thing. Season ticket information at grsf.org. Support also comes from Charter Bank, dedicated to investing in partnerships and offering Charter Bank business services with small business loans, treasury management services, and a variety of checking accounts. Details are at charterbank.bank. Well, last week we featured the first part of a conversation with percussionist David Whitman, recorded while he was back in Eau Claire. Last week we talked about the process of becoming part of the musical world that accepts you, the relationships that ensue, and how many mentors helped him become the musician he is today. This week it's oh so interesting how music can be dissected, looked and poked at, consumed or put back together, sometimes differently. It's conversations like these that make music so much more than what the ears enjoy. More about his album Soul Flow, released last month as well, a follow-up to the previous compilation, Eau Claire. You're listening to a piece from that right now. Ladies and gentlemen, David Whitman. Percussionists, and back to the drumming part, jazz drummers, it's not just quality when you're sitting behind a drum kit, it's also quantity. I mean, there's a fine line between you fitting in and you pissing somebody off because you're riffing a little bit too much.
Yeah, absolutely. No, you have to be a musician and you have to be tasteful.
Where does that come from?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. Some people might be gifted, you know, but with my teaching, I feel like people can learn these things. But for me personally, I feel like it has been a long-term endeavor. With study, I have books and books and books of transcriptions of drummer after drummer from recording after recording that I revered every note they played. You know, and not just like what they played on the melody of the song, but pages and pages of what they played throughout the whole song, throughout the solo. I learned a lot through that. Whole albums of the drum set parts all written out, and I would rewind measure after measure and listen to each measure, you know, maybe some measures 100, 200 times before I could really figure out exactly what they were playing and write it down just so with immaculate penmanship so that when I went back and looked at it and practiced it later, I could actually read it and think about it. And then, you know, I did a lot of that, and I combined that with what I learned about the art form of jazz and how it works with form and structure, and what I learned from, like, Luke Gillespie. He teaches at Indiana University, but he taught a listening class at Chelyuk Indian Head Art Center that I attended when I was in middle school.
Wow.
And it was a listening seminar every day of the camp at, like, 11 in the morning or something like that, and I remember everything he said. It was all about how to listen to jazz and how to listen to it through the lens of the overlay of the structure and the melody of the song, and then looking back at how, you know, what happens on the 12th bar, the form, you know, on this solo, and then what happens on the 12th bar, the form on that solo, and how do those things react, and what kind of conversations are happening in the music at the time, and what is the drummer doing throughout all of this to reinforce what's happening? Mm. I've dedicated, you know, a lot of time to studying that, and I feel like a lot of that gets to your question and shapes how a drummer rides that line between just fulfilling their role and being supportive and also contributing something to the music conversationally and artistically. And then on the other end of the spectrum, not getting into the way and destroying the music and the feel of the music as well.
Because if they like you, they'll eventually let you do a solo. Then you can do your stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But then at the same time, there are different types of, you know, as an art form, jazz music has different flavors. There are different concepts within which the art form can live, I think, is the way that I would put it. Mm. You know, when I was studying with David King, the great avant-garde jazz drummer, I don't know if he would appreciate me calling him that or not.
He might not hear this.
He might not hear it, yeah, but that's one way I think that he could be described, but certainly great. Oftentimes, the time that I had with him as a student that I appreciated the most were the times where he would give me records that he had been listening to or had found new material. He would give me a series of questions to compose written responses to for the next week's lesson. Okay. And sometimes these questions would be like, you know, within what conceptual boundaries is this album existing? You know, those kind of questions really got me thinking about how different approaches could be taken, how it could still be jazz. And sometimes for a drummer, being, you know, I think being a little more active and a little more engaged in the direction of the music that's happening, you know, is okay from a conceptual standpoint. If it's a decision, if it's like a brushstroke on a canvas that's broad, you know, then I think that's one thing. So I think you'll notice, like on the new record Soul Flow, I don't play exactly the same way that I played on Eau Claire because I'm working a little bit within different conceptual boundaries. But you'll notice, too, on future records, you know, I might sound a little bit more like I sounded on Eau Claire. Mm-hmm. Or I might be thinking of the music or the album overall in a different way as a sort of a different piece of work. So not every record I make is just going to be just David Whitman and his jazz.
Sure.
There are different statements. And I think that's part of who I am, largely due to all the work that I do as a percussionist and playing with all the different acts that come through.
Something you just said made me say, well, you got to ask this question. This mentor of his, what was his name, King?
David King.
He'd give you music to say, okay, so what conceptual boundaries are contained on that particular piece? Is there actually a right or wrong answer to that kind of a question?
No, I think that's a fair question in and of itself. I think he would probably agree that there isn't a right or wrong answer.
Or, he wasn't looking for something.
Maybe, no, I don't think so. Okay. Maybe certain things.
He just wanted to know that you were listening and had an opinion.
Right, right. And he wanted to foster and encourage that creative thinking. But I do believe that with those types of questions, sometimes there are wrong answers. But there are many right answers. Okay. I think that's a good way to put it. You know, and he would ask me great questions like, David, if you were just going to play one bass drum note for every, you know, cycle of the structure, you know, how would you do that and why and where would those notes go? And, you know, it's almost like the question itself didn't even matter to him or to me, but it just triggered thinking in a new way that still flowers to this day. And I'm so thankful for him and what he did with me in that regard. Yeah.
You have just released Soul Flow. It is the follow-up to Eau Claire, although they are dissimilar projects. It's jazz as I like it. I guess I have a certain jazz taste. And now comes Soul Flow. So what's the difference?
Well, so Eau Claire is a septet, and Soul Flow is a quartet.
Okay.
And it's a Hammond B3 quartet. So there's no bass guitar. The Hammond B3 organ player plays the bass lines with his pedal board. And then there's trumpet and trombone. So it's a smaller group. I think from a groove standpoint, we can get a little bit deeper because there's just two people rather than, you know, three or four in the rhythm section, which is one thing I really love about the sort of genre of the organ trio or quartet or an organ group. This particular record is kind of a throwback to Larry Young's album Unity. At least that album was the inspiration for the record. It was a Blue Note release, and Larry Young was an organ player And the album originally included trumpet and saxophone. And so I replaced saxophone with trombone because I like to do things my own way, but also to get a little bit different color, emphasize the brass a little bit more. And then also, it's 2019. You know, the language on the record is, you know,
not much longer,
it's
by
modern.
The way.
Yeah, that's right. Not much longer. Soon to be 2020. Yeah, and it's like, you know, all the players on the record are really at the forefront of jazz today, really moving the needle forward in terms of playing and the language and creativity. And they all have a voice. We are doing something that has been done before. The album is looking back to an earlier time, but it's certainly done in a new way. And I think it brings in elements of fusion that haven't really surfaced in jazz much in the last 30 years, that kind of come a little bit more from rock and blues, perhaps, than funk or some of the modern jazz that we hear today.
Fusion, yeah. I have to get into that a little more. Even at my age, I love delving into all this stuff, so it's cool. And thank you for being one of the guys who's introducing it to me. It feels to me like the title of the album, Soul Flow, says something about what we're hearing.
Oh, sure. I wrote all the tunes on the record. Yeah. On Eau Claire, most of those songs were written by Andrew Neasley. They were all his arrangements. On Soul Flow, they're all my tunes, with the exception of one. Andrew did do one as well. And I still work with Andrew. He did the album design.
Another UW Eau Claire grad, by the way.
And a great friend of mine and longtime collaborator. Mm-hmm. He and I have worked together our whole lives in many different ways.
And John Raymond is...
Raymond is playing on trumpet on the album, and he is an Eau Claire graduate, really at the forefront of jazz trumpet today. He teaches in Indiana at the School of Music there. And Jared Gold plays organ, lives in New Jersey, one of the most well-respected organ players today. And then, of course, Francisco Torres on trombone plays on everything. Yeah. Everybody wants him. You know, he's a brilliant player and a wonderful human being based out of L.A. In my neck of the woods. And he and I get to play together every now and again. He plays in Gordon Goodwin's band and works with Pancho Sanchez and everything. But, you know, but first and foremost, he is on his own, just a brilliant player, always doing his own thing all over the world. People want to have him come and play because he's such a great man and teacher and player.
But what's a typical week like for David Whitman? You get calls and you just show up and you do gigs?
I do teach, so I go to schools every day. I go to school every day and teach. But also, there's a constant influx of, you know, offers through various union contractors and artists, you know, looking for percussionists, you know, asking me if I'm available to play. You know, there's a lot of administrative tasks, managing schedules and things. And at the same time, you know, lots with promotion for my own music, which actually, unfortunately, I get to do very little of. So I am extremely grateful to be here and recording, you know, our conversation. With everything I do have very little opportunity to promote my music. But there is time and energy spent on that, depending on what's going on. Mixing and mastering or listening.
Do you have a studio?
I don't, but, okay. You know, working on projects of my own, going back and forth with the people who do that. I like to specialize in playing and writing music and that side of things. But if I am doing a record or working on a project like that, I'm there every step of the way for those processes and, you know, really have something in mind that I work together with the people who do it to achieve. That's sometimes a process that takes a long time and it's ongoing. I rent equipment sometimes to, you know, orchestras or bands if they're coming through. So I sometimes deal with administrative stuff on that end, and I have equipment to maintain. So I'll get home in the evening and maybe get to eat a little dinner with the family, or maybe just spend a little time with my children. And then when they're asleep, I'll go to a commercial space that I have that's really like a warehouse where all my percussion equipment is, and I will prepare the music that I need to be preparing at the time. There's a lot of blue-collar work involved, moving equipment, and, you know, and I practice 2 hours a day, you know, at a minimum almost, and if I'm really in something and I have the time, you know, I could be practicing all day long. When I composed Soul Flow, it was about 3 weeks before the session. And I spent about 2 weeks straight, all day, every day, composing and preparing for that particular project. You know, I get offers for festivals sometimes, and I'll do them if it's on a weekend. You know, I work for a charter school, and you know, I think fundamentally I'm just an everyman's, you know, working man. I go to work, and you know, my employers know that about all the music stuff that I do. But at this point in my career, I still don't really flitter off and leave school to go play everywhere. Don't feel like it's the right decision for me from an employee loyalty standpoint. I do play when I can, but no, I'm hoping that in the coming years I get to travel and play my own music much more.
Sounds like a great name for an album, Flitter Off.
Flitter Off, hey, yeah. And I'm always shopping for a great name for an album. That's the toughest part sometimes.
Yeah, no, I think that's what musicians do. You're not a guy that rests on your laurels. As you dive into new things, is it always your intention to then do something completely different?
Not necessarily completely different, but I do have one album coming out. It's in the wings, ready to come out next year.
Okay.
And I don't want to give too much away about that, but I will say it will be a return to my septet. You know, I do so many things. Nothing is really in front of my face for very long, even on a daily or an hour-by-hour basis. Trying to sleep and manage the basic logistics of day-to-day life. So I'm lucky that I'm able to get a record out at all.
Good. Well, as those records come out, be sure that they're all sent our way.
Hey, all right.
I'd appreciate that. You know, once a blue gold, always a blue gold. And even though we're about 1,700 some odd miles apart, keep in touch. It's so much fun to talk to you. And
thank you very much, Al.
And I love your music, and so do a lot of other people. And we're looking forward to the new stuff.
I love your show. I've listened to your voice for a long time, and I have so much respect for you and your show and the people of this area, my people, and where I'm from. It's home.
Let's do this again.
Oh, it sounds great. It'd be a pleasure.
Thank you. The album's called Soul Flow. You're listening to some of it in the background. Check him out at davidwhitmanmusic.com. And as I said, we'll keep in touch. Hey, guys, remember, Saturday is the 7th Eau Claire Improv Festival at the Metro in downtown Eau Claire. Advance tickets at volume1tickets.org. Coming up next week, a couple of bees, Banbury, and baseball, and lots more as usual. Thanks to Dean, Kate, Catherine, Thomas, Jim Oliver, and thank you especially. Keep in touch on Facebook via email, spectrumwest@wpr.org. This is so much fun. See you next week. Bye.